For her 34th birthday, we flew to Barcelona, and she stunned me by rolling off trills of conversational Spanish, learned in months of secret lessons. My wife had a brilliant, popping brain, a greedy curiosity, but her obsessions tended to be fueled by competition. She needed to dazzle men and jealousify women. Of course Amy can cook French cuisine and speak fluent Spanish and garden and knit and run marathons and day trade stocks and fly a plane and look like a runway model doing it. She needed to be Amazing Amy all the time. Here in Missouri, the women shop at Target. They make diligent, comforting meals. They laugh about how little high school Spanish they remember. Competition doesn't interest them. Amy's relentless achieving is greeted with open-palmed acceptance, and maybe a bit of pity. It was about the worst outcome possible for my competitive wife, a town of contented also-rans. She has a lot of hobbies, I said. Anything worrying you? Boney asked, looking worried. You're not concerned about drugs or drinking? I'm not speaking ill of your wife. A lot of housewives, more than you'd guess. They pass the day that way. The days, they get long when you're by yourself. And if the drinking turns to drugs, and I'm not talking heroin, but even prescription painkillers, well, there are some pretty awful characters selling around here right now.
The drug trade has gotten bad, Gilpin said. We've had a bunch of police layoffs, one-fifth of the force, and we were tight to begin with. I mean, it's bad. We're overrun.
Had a housewife, nice lady, get a tooth knocked out last month over some OxyContin, Boney prompted. No, Amy might have a glass of wine or something, but not drugs. Boney eyed me. This was clearly not the answer she wanted. She have some good friends here? We'd like to call some of them, just make sure. No offense. Sometimes a spouse is the last to know when drugs are involved. People get ashamed, especially women. Friends. In New York, Amy made and shed friends weekly. They were like her projects. She'd get intensely excited about them. Paula, who gave her singing lessons and had a wicked good voice. Amy went to boarding school in Massachusetts. I loved the very occasional time she got all New England on me. Wicked good. Jessie from the fashion design course. But then I'd ask about Jessie or Paula a month later, and Amy would look at me like I was making up words. Then there were the men who were always rattling behind Amy, eager to do the husbandly things that her husband failed to do. Fix a chair leg. Hunt down her favorite imported Asian tea. Men who she swore were her friends, just good friends. Amy kept them at exactly an arm's distance, far enough away that I couldn't get too annoyed, close enough that she could crook a finger and they'd do her bidding. In Missouri, good God, I really didn't know. It only occurred to me just then. You truly are an asshole, I thought. 2 years we'd been here, and after the initial flurry of meet and greets, those manic first months, Amy had no one she regularly saw. She had my mom, who was now dead, and me, and our main form of conversation was attack and rebuttal. When we'd been back home for a year, I'd asked her faux gallantly, "And how are you liking North Carthage, Mrs. Dunn?"
"New Carthage, you mean?"
she'd replied. I refused to ask her the reference, but I knew it was an insult. She has a few good friends, but they're mostly back east.
Her folks?
They live in New York City.
And you still haven't called any of these people?
Bonnie asked, a bemused smile on her face.
I've been doing everything else you've been asking me to do. I haven't had a chance.
I'd signed away permission to trace credit cards and ATMs and track Amy's cell phone. I'd handed over Go's cell number and the name of Sue, the widow at the bar, who could presumably attest to the time I arrived.
Baby of the family, she shook her head. You really do remind me of my little brother.
A beat.
That's a compliment, I swear.
She dotes on him, Gilpin said, scribbling in a notebook. Okay, so you left the house at about 7:30 a.m., and you showed up at the bar at about noon, and in between, you were at the beach.
There's a beachhead about 10 miles north of our house, a not overly pleasant collection of sand and silt and beer bottle shards, trash barrels overflowing with styrofoam cups and dirty diapers. But there is a picnic table upwind that gets nice sun, and if you stare directly at the river, you can ignore the other crap.
I sometimes bring my coffee and the paper and just sit. Gotta make the most of summer.
No, I hadn't talked to anyone at the beach. No, no one saw me.
It's a quiet place midweek, Gilpin allowed.
If the police talked to anyone who knew me, they'd quickly learn that I rarely went to the beach, and that I never sometimes brought my coffee to just enjoy the morning. I have Irish white skin and an impatience for navel-gazing. A beach boy I am not. I told the police that because it had been Amy's idea for me to go sit in the spot where I could be alone and watch the river I loved and ponder our life together. She'd said this to me this morning after we'd eaten her crepes. She leaned forward on the table and said, I know we are having a tough time. I still love you so much, Nick, and I know I have a lot of things to work on. I want to be a good wife to you, and I want you to be my husband and be happy. But you need to decide what you want.
She'd clearly been practicing the speech. She smiled proudly as she said it. And even as my wife was offering me this kindness, I was thinking, of course she has to stage manage this. She wants the image of me and the wild running river, my hair ruffling in the breeze as I look out onto the horizon and ponder our life together. I can't just go to Dunkin' Donuts.
You need to decide what you want.
Unfortunately for Amy, I had decided already.
Bonnie looked up brightly from her notes.
Can you tell me what your wife's blood type is? She asked.
No. I don't know.
You don't know your wife's blood type?
Maybe O? I guessed.
Bonnie frowned, then made a drawn-out yoga-like sound.
Okay, Nick. Here are the things we are doing to help.
She listed them. Amy's cell was being monitored, her photo circulated, her credit cards tracked. Known sex offenders in the area were being interviewed. Our sparse neighborhood was being canvassed. Our home phone was tapped in case any ransom calls came in. I wasn't sure what to say now. I raked my memory for the lines. What does the husband say at this point in the movie?
Depends on whether he's guilty or innocent. I can't say that reassures me. Is this an abduction or a missing persons case? Or what exactly is going on?
I knew the statistics, knew them from the same TV show I was starring in. If the first 48 hours didn't turn up something in a case, it was likely to go unsolved. The first 48 hours were crucial.
I mean, my wife is gone. My wife is gone! I realized it was the first time I'd said it the way it should have been said, panicked and angry. My dad was a man of infinite varieties of bitterness, rage, distaste. In my lifelong struggle to avoid becoming him, I'd developed an inability to demonstrate much negative emotion at all. It was another thing that made me seem like a dick. My stomach could be all oiled eels, and you would get nothing from my face and less from my words. It was a constant problem. Too much control, or no control at all.
"Nick, we are taking this extremely seriously," Boney said. "The lab guys are over at your place as we speak, and that will give us more information to go on. Right now, the more you can tell us about your wife, the better. What is she like?"
The usual husband phrases came into my mind. She's sweet. She's great. She's nice. She's supportive.
"What is she like? How?" I asked.
"Give me an idea of her personality," Boney prompted.
"Like, what did you get her for your anniversary? Jewelry?"
"I hadn't gotten anything quite yet," I said. "I was going to do it this afternoon." I waited for her to laugh and say, "baby of the family" again, but she didn't.
"Okay, well then, tell me about her. Is she outgoing? Is she, I don't know how to say this, is she New York-y? Like, what might come off to some as rude, might rub people the wrong way?"
"I don't know. She's not a never-met-a-stranger kind of person, but she's not abrasive enough to make someone hurt her." This was my 11th lie. The Amy of today was abrasive enough to want to hurt, sometimes. I speak specifically of the Amy of today, who is only remotely like the woman I fell in love with. It had been an awful fairy tale reverse transformation. Over just a few years, the old Amy, the girl of the big laugh and the easy ways, literally shed herself, a pile of skin and soul on the floor, and out stepped this new, brittle, bitter Amy. My wife was no longer my wife, but a razor wire knot, daring me to unloop her. And I was not up to the job with my thick, numb, nervous fingers. Country fingers. Flyover fingers untrained in the intricate, dangerous work of solving Amy. When I'd hold up the bloody stumps, she'd sigh and turn to her secret mental notebook on which she tallied all my deficiencies, forever noting disappointments, frailties, shortcomings. My old Amy, damn, she was fun. She was funny. She made me laugh. I'd forgotten that. And she laughed. From the bottom of her throat, from right behind that small finger-shaped hollow, which is the best place to laugh from, she released her grievances like handfuls of birdseed. They are there, and they are gone. She was not the thing she became, the thing I feared most, an angry woman. I was not good with angry women. They brought something out in me that was unsavory.
"She bossy?" Gilpin asked. "Take charge?"
I thought of Amy's calendar, the one that went 3 years into the future, and if you looked a year ahead, you would actually find appointments. Dermatologist, dentist, vet.
"She's a planner. She doesn't, you know, wing anything. She likes to make lists and check things off. Get things done."
"That's why this doesn't make sense."
"That can drive you crazy," Boney said sympathetically, "if you're not that type.
You seem very B personality.
I'm a little more laid back, I guess, I said. Then I added the part I was supposed to add. We round each other out. I looked at the clock on the wall, and Boney touched my hand.
Hey, why don't you go ahead and give a call to Amy's parents? I'm sure they'd appreciate it.
It was past midnight. Amy's parents went to sleep at 9 p.m. They were strangely boastful about this early bedtime. They'd be deep asleep by now, so this would be an urgent middle-of-the-night call. Cells went off at 8:45 always, so Rand Elliott would have to walk from his bed all the way to the end of the hall to pick up the old, heavy phone. He'd be fumbling with his glasses, fussy with the table lamp. He'd be telling himself all the reasons not to worry about a late-night phone call, all the harmless reasons the phone might be ringing. I dialed twice and hung up before I let the call ring through. When I did, it was Mary Beth, not Rand, who answered, her deep voice buzzing my ears. I'd only gotten to, "Mary Beth, this is Nick," when I lost it.
"What is it, Nick?"
I took a breath.
"Is it Amy? Tell me."
I'm sorry, I should have called.
"Tell me, goddammit!"
"We can't find Amy," I stuttered.
"You can't find Amy?"
"I don't know."
"Amy is missing?"
"We don't know that for sure. We're still..."
"Since when?"
"We're not sure. I left this morning a little after 7.
"And you waited till now to call us?"
"I'm sorry, I didn't want to."
"Jesus Christ, we played tennis tonight. Tennis, and we could have been..." "My God. Are the police involved? You've notified them?"
"I'm at the station right now."
"Put on whoever's in charge, Nick. Please."
Like a kid, I went to fetch Gilpin. "My mommy-in-law wants to talk to you." Phoning the Elliots made it official. The emergency, "Amy is gone," was spreading to the outside. I was heading back to the interview room when I heard my father's voice. Sometimes, in particularly shameful moments, I heard his voice in my head. But this was my father's voice, here. His words emerged in wet bubbles like something from a rancid bog.
"Bitch, bitch, bitch."
My father, out of his mind, had taken to flinging the word at any woman who even vaguely annoyed him.
"Bitch, bitch, bitch."
I peered inside a conference room, and there he sat on a bench against the wall. He had been a handsome man once, intense and cleft-chinned. Jarringly dreamy was how my aunt had described him. Now he sat muttering at the floor, his blonde hair matted, trousers muddy, and arms scratched, as if he'd fought his way through a thorn bush. A line of spittle glimmered down his chin like a snail's trail, and he was flexing and unflexing arm muscles that had not yet gone to seed. A tense female officer sat next to him, her lips in an angry pucker, trying to ignore him.
"Bitch, bitch, bitch, I told you, bitch."
"What's going on?" I asked her. "This is my father."
"You got our call?"
"What call?"
"To come get your father,"
she over-enunciated, as if I were a dim 10-year-old. My wife is missing. I've been here most of the night." She stared at me, not connecting in the least. I could see her debating whether to sacrifice her leverage and apologize, inquire.
Then my father started up again.
Bitch, bitch, bitch.
And she chose to keep the leverage.
Sir, Comfort Hill has been trying to contact you all day. Your father wandered out of fire exit early this morning. He's got a few scratches and scrapes, as you can see, but no damage. We picked him up a few hours ago, walking down River Road, disoriented. We've been trying to reach you.
I've been right here, I said.
Right goddamn next door. How did no one put this together?
Bitch, bitch, bitch,
said my dad.
Sir, please don't take that tone with me.
Bitch, bitch, bitch.
Boney ordered an officer, male, to drive my dad back to the home so I could finish up with them. We stood on the stairs outside the police station, watched him get settled into the car, still muttering. The entire time, he never registered my presence. When they drove off, he didn't even look back.
You guys not close?
She asked. We are the definition of not close. The police finished with their questions and hustled me into a squad car at about 2 a.m. with advice to get a good night's sleep and return at 11 for a 12 noon press conference. I didn't ask if I could go home. I had them take me to Go's because I knew she'd stay up and have a drink with me, fix me a sandwich. It was, pathetically, all I wanted right then. A woman to fix me a sandwich and not ask me any questions.
You don't want to go look for her?
Go offered as I ate.
We can drive around.
That seems pointless, I said dully. Where do I look?
Nick, this is really fucking serious.
I know, Go.
Act like it, okay, Lance? Don't fucking num 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 num.
It was a thick-tongued noise, the noise she always made to convey my indecisiveness, accompanied by a dazed rolling of the eyes and the dusting off of my legal first name. No one who has my face needs to be called Lance. She handed me a tumbler of scotch.
And drink this, but only this. You don't want to be hungover tomorrow. Where the fuck could she be? God, I feel sick to my stomach.
She poured herself a glass, gulped, then tried to sip, pacing around the kitchen.
Aren't you worried, Nick? That some guy, like, saw her on the street and just decided to take her? Hit her on the head and...
I started.
Why did you say hit her on the head? What the fuck is that? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to paint a picture. I don't know. I just keep thinking about some crazy person.
She splashed some more scotch into her tumbler. Speaking of crazy people, I said, Dad got out again today. They found him wandering down River Road. He's back at Comfort now. She shrugged. Okay. It was the third time in 6 months that our dad had slipped out. Go was lighting a cigarette, her thoughts still on Amy.
I mean, isn't there someone we can go talk to?
She asked.
Something we can do? Jesus, Go! You really need me to feel more fucking impotent than I do right now?
I snapped.
I have no idea what I'm supposed to be doing. There's no when your wife goes missing 101. The police told me I could leave. I left. I'm just doing what they tell me.
Of course you are, murmured Go, who had a long stymied mission to turn me into a rebel. It wouldn't take. I was the kid in high school who made curfew. I was the writer who hit my deadlines, even the fake ones. I respect rules. Because if you follow rules, things go smoothly, usually.
Fuck, Go. I'm back at the station in a few hours, okay? Can you please just be nice to me for a second? I'm scared shitless.
We had a 5-second staring contest, then Go filled up my glass one more time, an apology. She sat down next to me, put a hand on my shoulder.
Poor Amy, she said.
Amy Elliott Dunn, April 21st, 2009. Diary entry. Poor me. Let me set the scene. Campbell and Inslee and I are all down in Soho, having dinner at Tableau. Lots of goat cheese tarts, lamb meatballs, and rocket greens. I'm not sure what all the fuss is about, but we are working backward. Dinner first, then drinks in one of the little nooks Campbell has reserved. A mini closet where you can lounge expensively in a place that's not too different from, say, your living room. But fine, it's fun to do the silly, trendy things sometimes. We are all overdressed in our little flashy frocks, our slasher heels, and we all eat small plates of food bites that are as decorative and unsubstantial as we are. We've discussed having our husbands drop by to join us for the drinks portion. So there we are, post-dinner, tucked into our nook, mojitos and martinis and my bourbon delivered to us by a waitress who could be auditioning for the small role of fresh-faced girl just off the bus. We are running out of things to say. It is a Tuesday, and no one is feeling like it is anything but. The drinks are being carefully drunk. Inslee and Campbell both have vague appointments the next morning, and I have work, so we aren't gearing up for a big night. We are winding down, and we are getting dull-witted, bored. We would leave if we weren't waiting for the possible appearance of the men. Campbell keeps peeking at her BlackBerry. Inslee studies her flexed calves from different angles. John arrives first. Huge apologies to Campbell. Big smiles and kisses for us all. A man just thrilled to be here, just delighted to arrive at the tail end of a cocktail hour across town so he can guzzle a drink and head home with his wife. George shows up about 20 minutes later. Sheepish, tense, a terse excuse about work, Inslee snapping at him, "You're 40 minutes late." Him nipping back, "Yeah, sorry about making us money." The two barely talking to each other as they make conversation with everyone else. Nick never shows. No call. We wait another 45 minutes. Campbell, solicitous. "Probably got hit with some last-minute deadline," she says, and smiles toward good old John, who never lets last-minute deadlines interfere with his wife's plans. Inslee's anger thawing toward her husband as she realizes he is only the second biggest jackass of the group.
"You sure he hasn't even texted, sweetie?"
Me? I just smile.
"Who knows where he is? I'll catch him at home."
And then it is the men of the group who look stricken.
"You mean that was an option? Take a pass on the night with no nasty consequences? No guilt or anger or sulking?"
"Well, maybe not for you guys."
Nick and I, we sometimes laugh out loud at the horrible things women make their husbands do to prove their love. The pointless tasks, the myriad sacrifices, the endless small surrenders. We call these men the dancing monkeys. Nick will come home, sweaty and salty and beer loose from a day at the ballpark, and I'll curl up in his lap, ask him about the game, ask him if his friend Jack had a good time, and he'll say,
"Oh, he came down with a case of the dancing monkeys. Poor Jennifer was having a real stressful week and really needed him at home."
Or his buddy at work, who can't go out for drinks because his girlfriend really needs him to stop by some bistro where she is having dinner with a friend from out of town, so they can finally meet, and so she can show how obedient her monkey is. "He comes when I call, and look how well groomed."
Wear this, don't wear that, do this chore now and do this chore when you get a chance, and by that I mean now. And definitely, definitely give up the things you love for me, so I will have proof that you love me best. It's the female pissing contest. As we swan around our book clubs and our cocktail hours, there are few things women love more than being able to detail the sacrifices our men make for us. A call and response. The response being, "Oh, that's so sweet." I am happy not to be in that club. I don't partake. I don't get off on emotional coercion, on forcing Nick to play some happy hubby role. The shrugging, cheerful, dutiful, taking out the trash, honey, role. Every wife's dream man. The counterpoint to every man's fantasy of the sweet, hot, laid-back woman who loves sex and a stiff drink. I like to think I am confident and secure and mature enough to know Nick loves me without him constantly proving it. I don't need pathetic dancing monkey scenarios to repeat to my friends. I am content with letting him be himself. I don't know why women find that so hard. When I get home from dinner, my cab pulls up just as Nick is getting out of his own taxi, and he stands in the street with his arms out to me and a huge grin on his face. "Baby!" And I run and I jump up into his arms, and he presses a stubbly cheek against mine. "What did you do tonight?" I ask.
"Some guys were playing poker after work, so I hung around for a bit. Hope that was okay."
"Of course," I say. "More fun than my night."
"Who all showed up?"
"Oh, Campbell and Inslee and their dancing monkeys. Boring. You dodged a bullet. A really lame bullet." He squeezes me into him, those strong arms, and hauls me up the stairs.
"God, I love you," he says.
Then comes sex and a stiff drink and a night of sleep in a sweet, exhausted rat's tangle in our big, soft bed. Poor me.
Nick Dunn. One Day Gone. I didn't listen to Go about the booze. I finished half the bottle sitting on her sofa by myself, my 18th burst of adrenaline kicking in just when I thought I'd finally go to sleep. My eyes were shutting, I was shifting my pillow, my eyes were closed, and then I saw my wife, blood clotting her blonde hair, weeping and blind in pain, scraping herself along our kitchen floor, calling my name. "Nick! Nick! Nick!" I took repeated tugs on the bottle, psyching myself up for sleep, a losing routine. Sleep is like a cat. It only comes to you if you ignore it. I drank more and continued my mantra. Stop thinking. Swig. Empty your head. Swig. Now, seriously, empty your head. Do it now. Swig. You need to be sharp tomorrow. You need to sleep. Swig. I got nothing more than a fussy nap toward dawn. Woke up an hour later with a hangover. Not a disabling hangover, but decent. I was tender and dull. Fuggy. Maybe still a little drunk. I stutter-walked to Go's Subaru, the movement feeling alien, like my legs were on backward. I had temporary ownership of the car. The police had graciously accepted my gently used Jetta for inspection, along with my laptop. All just a formality, I was assured. I drove home to get myself some decent clothes. Three police cruisers sat on my block, our very few neighbors milling around. No Carl, but there was Jan Taverer, the Christian lady, and Mike, the father of the 3-year-old IVF triplets, Trinity, Topher,
and Tallulah.
I hate them all just by name, said Amy, a grave judge of anything trendy. When I mentioned that the name Amy was once trendy, my wife said, Nick, you know the story of my name.
I had no idea what she was talking about.
Jan nodded from a distance without meeting my eyes, but Mike strode over to me as I got out of my car.
I'm so sorry, man. Anything I can do, you let me know. Anything. I did the mowing this morning, so at least you don't need to worry about that.
Mike and I took turns mowing all the abandoned foreclosed properties in the complex. Heavy rains in the spring had turned yards into jungles, which encouraged an influx of raccoons. We had raccoons everywhere, gnawing through our garbage late at night, sneaking into our basements, lounging on our porches like lazy house pets. The mowing didn't seem to make them go away, but we could at least see them coming now.
Thanks, man. Thank you, I said.
Man, my wife, she's been hysterical since she heard, he said. Absolutely hysterical.
I'm so sorry to hear that, I said. I pointed at my door.
Just sitting around, crying over pictures of Amy.
I had no doubt that 1,000 internet photos had popped up overnight just to feed the pathetic needs of women like Mike's wife. I had no sympathy for drama queens.
Hey, I gotta ask, Mike started.
I patted his arm and pointed again at the door, as if I had pressing business. I turned away before he could ask any questions and knocked on the door of my own house. Officer Velasquez escorted me upstairs, into my own bedroom, into my own closet, past the silvery perfect square gift box, and let me rifle through my things. It made me tense, selecting clothes in front of this young woman with a long brown braid, this woman who had to be judging me, forming an opinion. I ended up grabbing blindly. The final look was business casual, slacks and short sleeves, like I was going to a convention. It would make an interesting essay, I thought, picking out appropriate clothes when a loved one goes missing. The greedy, angle-hungry writer in me, impossible to turn off. I jammed it all into a bag and turned back around, looking at the gift box on the floor.
Could I look inside? I asked her.
She hesitated, then played it safe.
No, I'm sorry, sir. Better not right now.
The edge of the gift wrapping had been carefully slit. Has somebody looked inside? She nodded. I stepped around Velasquez toward the box.
If it's already been looked at, then...
She stepped in front of me.
Sir, I can't let you do that.
This is ridiculous. It's for me, from my wife. I stepped back around her, bent down, and had one hand on the corner of the box when she slapped an arm across my chest from behind. I felt a momentary spurt of fury that this woman presumed to tell me what to do in my own home. No matter how hard I try to be my mother's son, my dad's voice comes into my head unbidden, depositing awful thoughts, nasty words.
Sir, this is a crime scene. You
stupid bitch.
Suddenly her partner, Reardon, was in the room and on me too. And I was shaking them off.
Fine, fine, fuck!
And they were forcing me down the stairs. A woman was on all fours near the front door, squirreling along the floorboards, searching, I assume, for blood spatter. She looked up at me impassively, then back down. I forced myself to decompress as I drove back to Go's to dress. This was only one in a long series of annoying and asinine things the police would do in the course of this investigation,
I like rules that make sense, not rules without logic. So I needed to calm down. Do not antagonize the cops, I told myself. Repeat if necessary. Do not antagonize the cops. I ran into Boney as I entered the police station, and she said, "Your in-laws are here, Nick," in an encouraging tone, like she was offering me a warm muffin. Mary Beth and Rand Elliott were standing with their arms around each other. Middle of the police station, they looked like they were posing for prom photos. That's how I always saw them, hands patting, chins nuzzling, cheeks rubbing. Whenever I visited the Elliott home, I became an obsessive throat clearer. "I'm about to enter," because the Elliots could be around any corner, cherishing each other. They kissed each other full on the mouth whenever they were parting, and Rand would cup his wife's rear as he passed her. It was foreign to me. My parents divorced when I was 12, and I think maybe when I was very young, I witnessed a chaste cheek kiss between the two when it was impossible to avoid. Christmas, birthdays, dry lips. On their best married days, their communications were entirely transactional. "We're out of milk again." "I'll get some today." "I need this ironed properly." "I'll do that today." "How hard is it to buy milk?" Silence. "You forgot to call the plumber." Sigh. "God damn it, put on your coat right now and go out and get some goddamn milk. Now!" These messages and orders brought to you by my father, a mid-level phone company manager, who treated my mother at best like an incompetent employee. At worst, he never beat her, but his pure, inarticulate fury would fill the house for days, weeks at a time, making the air humid, hard to breathe. My father stalking around with his lower jaw jutting out, giving him the look of a wounded, vengeful boxer, grinding his teeth so loud you could hear it across the room, throwing things near her, but not exactly at her. I'm sure he told himself, "I never hit her." I'm sure because of this technicality, he never saw himself as an abuser. But he turned our family life into an endless road trip with bad directions and a rage-clenched driver, a vacation that never got a chance to be fun. "Don't make me turn this car around." "Please, really, turn it around." I don't think my father's issue was with my mother in particular. He just didn't like women. He thought they were stupid, inconsequential, irritating. "That dumb bitch." It was his favorite phrase for any woman who annoyed him, a fellow motorist, a waitress, our grade school teachers, none of whom he ever actually met, parent-teacher conferences stinking of the female realm as they did. I still remember when Geraldine Ferraro was named the 1984 vice presidential candidate, us all watching it on the news before dinner. My mother, my tiny, sweet mom, put her hand on the back of Go's head and said, "Well, I think it's wonderful." And my dad flipped the TV off and said, "It's a joke. You know it's a goddamn joke. Like watching a monkey ride a bike." It took another 5 years before my mother finally decided she was done. I came home from school one day, and my father was gone. He was there in the morning and gone by the afternoon. My mom sat us down at the dining table and announced, "Your father and I have decided it would be best for everyone if we live apart." And Go burst into tears and said, "Good! I hate you both!" And then, instead of running to her room like the script called for, she went to my mom and hugged her. So my father went away, and my thin, pained mother got fat and happy. Fairly fat and extremely happy, as if she were supposed to be that way all along. A deflated balloon, taking in air. Within a year, she'd morphed into the busy, warm, cheerful lady she'd be till she died, and her sister said things like, "Thank God the old Marine is back," as if the woman who raised us was an imposter. As for my father, for years I spoke to him on the phone about once a month, the conversations polite and newsy, a recital of things that happened. The only question my father ever asked about Amy was, "How is Amy?" Which was not meant to elicit any answer beyond, "She's fine." He remained stubbornly distant even as he faded into dementia in his 60s.
"If you're always early, you're never late."
My dad's mantra, and that included the onset of Alzheimer's, a slow decline into a sudden steep drop that forced us to move our independent, misogynistic father to a giant home that stank of chicken broth and piss, where he'd be surrounded by women helping him at all times. Ha! My dad had limitations. That's what my good-hearted mom always told us. He had limitations, but he meant no harm. It was kind of her to say, but he did do harm. I doubt my sister will ever marry. If she's sad or upset or angry, she needs to be alone. She fears a man dismissing her womanly tears. I'm just as bad. The good stuff in me I got from my mom. I can joke, I can laugh, I can tease, I can celebrate and support and praise. I can operate in sunlight, basically. But I can't deal with angry or tearful women. I feel my father's rage rise up in me in the ugliest way. Amy could tell you about that. She would definitely tell you, if she were here. I watched Rand and Mary Beth for a moment before they saw me. I wondered how furious they'd be with me. I had committed an unforgivable act, not phoning them for so long. Because of my cowardice, my in-laws would always have that night of tennis lodged in their imagination. The warm evening, the lazy yellow balls bumping along the court, the squeak of tennis shoes, the average Thursday night they'd spent while their daughter was disappeared.
"Nick,"
Rand Elliott said, spotting me. He took three big strides toward me, and as I braced myself for a punch, he hugged me desperately hard.
"How are you holding up?"
he whispered into my neck and began rocking. Finally, he gave a high-pitched gulp, a swallowed sob, and gripped me by the arms.
"We're going to find Amy, Nick. It can't go any other way. Believe that, okay?"
Rand Elliott held me in his blue stare for a few more seconds, then broke up again. Three girlish gasps burst from him like hiccups, and Mary Beth moved into the huddle, buried her face in her husband's armpit. When we parted, she looked up at me with giant, stunned eyes.
"It's just a goddamn nightmare," she said. "How are you, Nick?"
When Mary Beth asked, "How are you?" it wasn't a courtesy. It was an existential question. She studied my face, and I was sure she was studying me and would continue to note my every thought and action. The Elliots believed that every trait should be considered, judged, categorized. It all means something. It can all be used. Mom, Dad, baby, they were three advanced people with three advanced degrees in psychology. They thought more before 9 a.m. than most people thought all month. I remember once declining cherry pie at dinner, and Ran cocked his head and said, "Ah, iconoclast. Disdains the easy symbolic patriotism." And when I tried to laugh it off and said, well, I didn't like cherry cobbler either, Mary Beth touched Rand's arm. "Because of the divorce, all those comfort foods, the desserts a family eats together, those are just bad memories for Nick." It was silly, but incredibly sweet. These people spending so much energy trying to figure me out. The answer, I don't like cherries. By 11:30, the station was a rolling boil of noise. Phones were ringing. People were yelling across the room. A woman whose name I never caught, whom I registered only as a chattering bobblehead of hair, suddenly made her presence known at my side. I had no idea how long she'd been there. "And the main point of this, Nick, is just to get people looking for Amy and knowing she has a family who loves her and wants her back. This will be very controlled. Nick, you will need to..." "Nick?"
"Yep."
"People will want to hear a quick statement from her husband." From across the room, Go was darting toward me. She'd dropped me at the station, then run by the bar to take care of bar things for 30 minutes, and now she was back, acting like she'd abandoned me for a week, zigzagging between desks, ignoring the young officer who'd clearly been assigned to usher her in, neatly, in a hushed, dignified manner. "Okay so far?" Go said, squeezing me with one arm, the dude hug. The Dunn kids don't perform hugs well. Go's thumb landed on my right nipple. "I wish Mom was here," she whispered, which was what I'd been thinking. "No news?" she asked when she pulled away. "Nothing. Fucking nothing." "You look like you feel awful." "I feel like fucking shit." I was about to say what an idiot I was, not listening to her about the booze. "I would have finished the bottle, too." She patted my back. "It's almost time," the PR woman said, again appearing magically. "It's not a bad turnout for a July 4th weekend." She started herding us all toward a dismal conference room, aluminum blinds and folding chairs and a clutch of bored reporters, and up onto the platform. I felt like a third-tier speaker at a mediocre convention, me in my business casual blues, addressing a captive audience of jet-lagged people, daydreaming about what they'd eat for lunch. But I could see the journalists perk up when they caught sight of me. Let's say it, a young, decent-looking guy. And then the PR woman placed a cardboard poster on a nearby easel, and it was a blown-up photo of Amy at her most stunning. That face that made you keep double-checking. She can't be that good-looking, can she? She could. She was. And I stared at the photo of my wife as the cameras snapped photos of me staring at the photo. I thought of that day in New York when I found her again. The blonde hair, the back of her head was all I could see. But I knew it was her, and I saw it as a sign. How many millions of heads had I seen in my life? But I knew this was Amy's pretty skull floating down 7th Avenue in front of me. I knew it was her, and that we would be together. Cameras flashed. I turned away and saw spots. It was surreal. That's what people always say to describe moments that are merely unusual. I thought, you have no fucking idea what surreal is. My hangover was really warming up now, my left eye throbbing like a heart. The cameras were clicking, and the two families stood together, all of us with mouths in thin slits. Go, the only one looking even close to a real person. The rest of us looked like placeholder humans, bodies that had been dollied in and propped up. Amy, over on her easel, looked more present. We'd all seen these news conferences before, when other women went missing. We were being forced to perform the scene that TV viewers expected, the worried but hopeful family, caffeine-dazed eyes, and ragdoll arms. My name was being said. The room gave a collective gulp of expectation. Showtime. When I saw the broadcast later, I didn't recognize my voice. I barely recognized my face. The booze, floating sludge-like just beneath the surface of my skin, made me look like a fleshy wastrel, just sensuous enough to be disreputable. I had worried about my voice wavering, so I overcorrected and the words came out clipped, like I was reading a stock report. "We just want Amy to get home safe." Utterly unconvincing, disconnected. I might as well have been reading numbers at random. Rand Elliott stepped up and tried to save me.
"Our daughter, Amy, is a sweetheart of a girl, full of life. She's our only child, and she's smart and beautiful and kind. She really is amazing, Amy. And we want her back. Nick wants her back."
He put a hand on my shoulder, wiped his eyes, and I involuntarily turned to Steele. My father again. Men don't cry. Rand kept talking.
"We all want her back where she belongs, with her family. We've set up a command center over at the Days Inn."
The news reports would show Nick Dunn, husband of the missing woman, standing metallically next to his father-in-law, arms crossed, eyes glazed, looking almost bored as Amy's parents wept. And then, worse. My long-time response. The need to remind people I wasn't a dick. I was a nice guy despite the affectless stare, the haughty douchebag face. So there it came, out of nowhere, as Rand begged for his daughter's return. A killer smile.
Amy Elliott Dunn, July 5th, 2010. Diary entry. I won't blame Nick. I don't blame Nick. I refuse to turn into some pert-mouthed, strident, angry girl. I made two promises to myself when I married Nick. One, no dancing monkey demands. Two, I would never, ever say, "Sure, that's fine by me. If you want to stay out later, if you want to do a boys' weekend, if you want to do something you want to do," and then punish him for doing what I said was fine by me. I worry I am coming perilously close to violating both of those promises. But still, it is our third wedding anniversary, and I am alone in our apartment, my face all masked tight from tears. Because. Just this afternoon, I get a voicemail from Nick, and I already know it's going to be bad. I know the second the voicemail begins, because I can tell he's calling from his cell, and I can hear men's voices in the background, and a big, roomy gap, like he's trying to decide what to say. And then I hear his taxi-blurred voice, a voice that is already wet and lazy with booze. And I know I am going to be angry. That quick inhale, the lips going tight, the shoulders up, the "I so don't want to be mad, but I'm going to be" feeling. Do men not know that feeling? You don't want to be mad, but you're obligated to be, almost. Because a rule, a good rule, a nice rule is being broken. Or maybe rule is the wrong word. Protocol, nicety. But the rule, protocol, nicety, our anniversary,
is being broken for a good reason. I understand. I do. The rumors were true. 16 writers have been laid off at Nick's magazine, a third of the